I'm Bae, and you're listening to Bae Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood in Baltimore. This episode, I watched Goodnight Mommy, starring Naomi Watts, which was a film that was released, I believe, on Amazon Prime September 16th or so. Anyway, it's a remake of an Austrian film from 2014 that I didn't realize I had watched until midway through this film, because the plot felt familiar to me. Turns out it's because I watched the 2014 version of this thing. So I have some thoughts, obviously. Once again, when you make a really good culturally relevant story, it's really hard to reproduce from one culture to the next, even though the premise or the plot of movies can switch, films, TV can get, you know, can switch, or at least you can have the same plot. The approach to a good film, again, I will say until the cows come home. I will use Squid Games as an example. You can't say that if Hollywood were to make a adaptation of Squid Games that it would be successful. I think it would pale in comparison. It wouldn't even come close. White Tiger, that Indian film from a couple of years ago, because of the cultural relevance that is buried inside the film, that is specific to India, caste system and all of that that still exists today, there's just no way that Hollywood could get its hands on it and make a remake that would even come close. And there's more. The Night of the Kings, the North African tale, I forgot what country it comes out of, but again, I would say this. If African Americans got a hold to the story and tried to do it, we'd come close. We wouldn't be able to surpass the Night of the Kings, but we get darn close because it's within the culture. It's just a different side of the culture. But yeah, there's just certain films that you cannot remake. Well, and there's an argument to be made. Anyway, I'm about to talk in a circle, and I do that sometimes, and I'm going to leave it. But yeah, this is not one of those films. This isn't one of those films. Because you can get here from just about any perspective. But you do need to come correct. That's the only thing. When you do film adaptations, you need to come correct. And there's a debate whether or not this Naomi Watts version of the film did come correct. So we'll get there in a second. But first, in honor of spooky season and the fact that I just enjoy, again, every opportunity, and I've said this before, which is why I'm saying it again, but I enjoy any opportunity to explore religion in some of the ways that maybe that you wouldn't expect. But I'm going to, well, and also I will maintain until my last breath that the scariest horror stories include religious elements in them. And to me, what some folks might not deem so scary is scary to me, because an aspect of my religious practice is the acknowledgement of entities that are otherworldly. I mean, when you break it all the way down, all religions, especially the Abrahamic religions, acknowledge the presence of, the existence of, and have remedies for combating spirits of otherworldly entities. And so anyway, those stories are fascinating to me, and I deal, well, from my perspective, those tend to make scarier horror stories to me. So anyway, throughout this month, as I am reviewing movies and TV shows that are spooky, scary, if they do not feature Black Americans or anyone from the diaspora, I'm going to get a story from somewhere that does feature Black Americans or folks in the diaspora. And I will feature it every episode where I'm not reviewing a film that includes folks in the African diaspora. So, because Mommy, Goodnight Mommy, does not have a lick of color in it, specifically a lick of anybody from the African diaspora, I'm going to bring you a story that I found on WGNO that is out of New Orleans, Louisiana. And so here it goes. So it reads, you might need some good gree-gree for this story about a stirring, nightmarish tale in the Treme community. Belfazar Ashantison is a traditional voodoo priest in New Orleans and says, voodoo in of itself is a healing tradition. When we get called for something, we automatically have the mind to heal the rift between somebody's ancestors and them. And I just want to pause right here because I'm assuming a lot here. So the Treme community is a popular community. It is an historic community in New Orleans. I believe the Treme community was impacted by Hurricane Katrina. Also, the Treme community is where the Mardi Gras parade ends. I do believe the parade ends in Treme, which is just off of the quarter, the French quarter, rather, in New Orleans. And the person that's talking, the voodoo priest, he's a voodoo priest, a voodooist. He's talking about voodooists themselves when they're, and I'm saying he, but they are talking about voodooists because you don't know the gender of this person when they're speaking. And I should have provided that context before. Belfazar Ashantison is a traditional voodoo priest in New Orleans and says, voodoo in and of itself is a healing tradition. When we get called for something, we automatically have the mind to heal the rift between somebody's ancestor and them. But seeing some of the things I have seen, I go in prepared for just about anything. Ashantison had an otherworldly encounter 3 years ago that would make blood curdle. He was assigned to help a family of clients for what was believed to be just a mild case of bad juju. What may have started out as a bit of negative energy had now become the food for something malicious inside of a family home. I knew something was off because as soon as I started getting closer to the house, goosebumps in the back of my neck went off and everything within me was saying, turn around. Things started feeling off. Things started falling off the walls and getting knocked off of shelves, and windows started rattling, says Ashantison. Ashantison believes to this day he was up against a Slender Man, which, pause, I really thought was fake because I had read about it I'd watched that the Slender Man movie or read about that case from those little white girls a couple of years ago where one of them was tormenting them and made up the Slender Man. So because I'm not a voodoo practitioner, I don't know a ton of the nuances to the entities that voodooists work against. But yeah, Ashantison thought he was up against, a Slender Man. And the way that Ashantison describes it in voodoo, a Slender Man is an entity with the intention of tormenting its victims. All I saw was the shadow of a person. It had extremely long arms and legs in the high corner, sitting there watching, says O'Shaughnessy. After fighting with the being for 4 hours with the use of camphor, Palo Santo, and sage, the entity had gone. The mind is an amazing thing. Many voodoo practitioners will tell you that in the voodoo religion, sometimes when you really want something to happen, it does. Sometimes when you really don't want something to happen, it does as well. And there's actually a lot to unpack in here. And I know this was a short little story. And I know this was WGNO is a TV station. And this was a part of their hometown horror stories, which was brought to you by sponsored by the mortuary, which I can only assume is either an awesome club or literally a funeral home. Anyway, that's where this story came from. And again, sometimes for me, the scary stories in the world are spiritual, they're spirit based. And can you even imagine? Have you even met a voodooist? You probably don't know that you have. But if you've ever met anyone who, as part of their work, helps to rid someone of bad energy, or spiritually help them through a negative situation, that's some tough stuff. That's some tough work, and it's not built. You have to be built for it. And when you read about voodooists, voodoo priests, practicing and supporting folks, they're not too totally different from Catholic priests or Christian, like Southern Baptist pastors or ministers who, through their faith, recognize that a family is being tormented, individuals being tormented in some way, and they set to, with the power of their faith, help free that person. In the manner of their tradition, from whatever is haunting them, as it were. The non-spiritual world would call it a haunting. Probably the spiritual world calls it a haunting too, because it is a type of haunting. But anyway, the amount of steel you have to have in your spine, the fortitude, the knowledge of self that you have to have in order to engage in those situations on a regular basis. I couldn't imagine. And certainly I'd be too chicken to, well, listen, anyone who'd do what they had to, if they were impacted or someone they loved were deeply impacted, but that takes a lot of stamina and backbone. And so anyway, reading a story like this, just imagine. And again, depending on your traditional faith or your faith tradition, stories like this exist. I'm reminded of the fact that in voodoo, John the Baptist is viewed as the first conjure man. And if you remember the story of John the Baptist, this was the guy that baptized Jesus in the Christian faith, baptized Jesus, lived in caves, ate locusts and wild honey for sustenance, isolated himself from the rest of the world the rest of his known world, because he was so true to his faith and so wrapped up spiritually in, well, didn't isolate himself all the time. It's just, he was a bit different. He was built differently. And so anyway, I don't want to oversimplify voodoo priests and their work that they do, but I can only imagine that the work that they do, because again, elements of Christianity are built in hoodoo and aspects of voodoo. Yeah, I just can't. I see a lot of comparisons. That's what I wanted to say, basically. Anyway, this story was scary to me. The idea that you could encounter a spiritual being that was malicious in intent and then go to war with it is scary. Because again, depending on your traditional, your faith tradition, this is a part of your faith tradition that this would happen. And somebody's got to be strong enough to harness the power of your faith to rid the people or themselves of it, of this scary entity. Anyway, scary stuff. Okay. I think that's enough of that, honestly. I think if I can share aspects of a religion, I want to do that too. Even though I'm not a religious scholar, I just enjoy studying religions. And I think I'm going to find a story about a jinn, J-I-N, which is acknowledged in the Muslim faith. I think I'll bring that next time if I can find a good story. Anyway, but let's shift into talking about ghost stories, scary stories, scenarios that would just be terrifying to you before we shift into talking about Goodnight Mommy. And I've said this before, so I've already said that spiritual-based stories are just ripe for exploiting to be scary, because some of the true stories that exist in life are scary because of what you're dealing with. And so it's too easy, I would think, to try to harness a good scary story. Now, Hollywood goes overboard. Actually, the film industries tend to go overboard to dramatize these stories. And sometimes the cleanest story is just told simply because it's scary enough. But I'm reminded also of how, in addition to religious-based stories being the best basis for horror, that stories involving children also are terrifying, can be some of the most terrifying. I'm reminded, why do you think Poltergeist was so successful? Was it just that it was spiritual based? And I'm kind of, go with me for a second. Was it just that it was spiritual based? Or was it that this entity, this negative evil entity, was targeting a child? For me, it was the targeting of the child piece that was upsetting to me, that made it a good horror film for me. What about The Good Son? I think it's a 90s movie. I can't remember. It's the early 90s, starring Macaulay Culkin. Would you consider that a horror story? I would, because again, it acknowledges that people that we consider innocent, and children are innocent. children do need protection. People, children need to be protected at all costs because they're vulnerable, right? But in this context of the good son, what makes the good son so horrific is because this, in the eyes of the director and the producers, what you and the screenwriters, you get the sense that we are meant to think Macaulay Culkin's character has an angelic face, and for all intents and purposes, is a sweet child to adults, but a malicious, evil kid to other children. A harmful being, a harmful entity. Well, not even an entity, just harmful to other kids. And there was a 1940s or 50s film that was based on this principle. It was a little girl. I cannot remember the name of it, but it featured a little girl who was just bad, literally called the bad seed. That's what it was. Literally called the bad seed. But the girl was bad, and she didn't look bad. Like, she didn't act bad to adults, except she started to slip at the end, just like in The Good Son. Where I think I remember the premise that the mom had remarried, and so this was a blended family situation, and so the child from the first marriage came in to the picture, and Macaulay Culkin's character, I think the other kid. Excuse me, the other kid was Elijah Wood. So it was Elijah Wood was the good kid and Macaulay Culkin was the bad kid. But the bad kid with the angelic face. And so throughout the film, Elijah Wood's character is supposed to be the long-suffering, truly innocent child who is the victim of this seemingly innocent but actually cruel an evil angelic face child. And anyway, to me, and it's been so many years since I've watched this film, but when I did watch it as a teenager, what made me, I must have watched it on HBO or went over one of my friends and watched it on VHS. But anyway, the idea that as a viewer, you get the sense that the director, the screenwriters, everybody involved in this thing wanted us to be terrified of Macaulay Culkin's character because he was so evil, he was capable of murder. And we were reminded of this, I think, early on in the film. And I think this film came out in a time, even though it was I wouldn't call it an adaptation or even a remake of The Bad Seed. Actually, maybe I would, because the little girl in Bad Seed had an angelic face too. And well, the directors wanted us to think that, oh, look at this cherub looking white child. Sweet faced. This child could not do any harm, right? Wrong. And so anyway, you know, the viewer is set to believe that Macaulay Culkin's character is a charmer. And he is. And manipulative. Big time. And so anyway, the most shocking thing about it is the evil things that he does. And he gets away with it because the parents are guilty. The parents, I think, yeah, because he's exploiting their guilt, the parents' guilt. And he's able to do it throughout the film until there's a change. And I think this film came out in a time where the science on what children are capable was evolving. We know today, even today, and I'm taking a little bit of a detour, but even up to today, we recognize that children as young as 6 years old and probably younger can experience depression, right? And I'm bringing that up for a reason, and because they can. There are cases of children living with clinical depression. I can remember as a teenager, I think I've shared this before, but my homegirl, maybe it's been many years since I've shared this story, but my homegirl at the time was hospitalized in a mental health center. She had, this was following a very alarming instance where she was so distraught and so, the only way I could describe it based on what she told me, it was that she just didn't have any hope. So she jumped in a lake nearby her house in the middle of winter. Literally, that's what happened. And her mother told me this, actually. And then when I was able to talk with her and just be a friend to her, she explained to me why that situation was. But anyway, why she felt that way, and then she shared her experience being in the mental health center. And what she explained to me was that she was in a children's ward. She was a teenager at the time, but she was in the children's ward. And she said that there were kids that were like 7 years old that were in the facility with her, which was striking to me. But looking back on it, again, working in mental health, recognizing what I do, children, we don't like to think children would have any reason to be depressed or be living with any sort of condition. But the science says otherwise. The science says that depression isn't always situational. It's not always, depression can be chemical. Mental health conditions can be chemical. Can be something that is biological in their body, in their brain. And there's actually, I'm really dumbing this down. I'm not doing it justice. Dumbing it down. That's not what I meant. I'm not doing the explanation of why children can develop mental health conditions. I'm not doing it justice. But the fact remains, my overarching point was that up until recently, and by recently, I mean in the last 5 years, even 10 years, really, I think as a society, not just a Western culture, but like as a society, I don't think we didn't acknowledge that children could be living with mental health conditions in a serious way. But I think when The Good Son came out, I think we were beginning to understand that children could be impacted by mental health at a very young age, because largely we were doing a lot of studies on, what's the right term for this? Children who were engaged in bad behavior, self-harm, harming others. That was coming into the forefront. We weren't, when the Good Son came out, we weren't at a place where we were saying, oh, children, largely as a society, and a Western society anyway, that children could be living with these conditions. What we were saying is, what we were seeing was children being bad, considered bad, and committing crimes, and wanting to diagnose that. And so this movie comes out in the midst of that, and of course it would feature two boys, one of whom is, I mean, let's be for real, The Good Son, that child is homicidal. Macaulay Culkin's character is homicidal. And that's not like a clinical, I don't think that's like a clinical term, but like, this child is capable of committing murder. And what we know is that there were high-profile cases of young children doing just that in the 90s. And so this film feels like it plays off of that a little bit, while also being a something like a remake to The Bad Seed, which was not necessarily a time where we acknowledged that kids could experience conditions that adults could or were capable of actions that adults were. This was a cautionary tale of being a good child. And parents, raise your children up in the way that they should go so that when they are old, they will never leave you or they will never turn away from your teachings. So be a good parent, and children, be good children. Like, it was a cautionary tale like that. But the reality of it is kids were committing some serious crimes that were considered to be adult crimes. Even then, it's just it wasn't widely talked about. But, you know, I cannot remember their name, but it was a teenager and her 20-something-year-old boyfriend who went on a crime spree through Kansas. I can't remember the names, but anyway, we have examples, real life examples of children being engaged in some very devious behavior, harmful behavior. But we still, as a society, specifically in the Western world, think of children as wholly vulnerable and not capable of committing crimes, doing terrible things, harming anyone on purpose. And with malicious intent. And so when you get to a story like The Good Son, which exploits the idea, our notion that kids can do no wrong, it's super scary to be confronted with that. But also when you go back to The Poltergeist, it's like the opposite version. It's reinforcing the fact that, oh my goodness, children are innocent, and look what's happening to this innocent child. So that's scary. Those are pretty scary in those respects. So I will forever maintain that spiritual-based stories and stories that are involving children, and then stories that combine both children and spirituality in a horror, like horror films that include elements of spirituality and include children, dumb scary to me, just dumb scary. But anyway, so the movie for today, Mommy, Goodnight Mommy, this includes kids. And so it's that kid element, and there's a suspense around the plot, around the story, and it takes you through twists and turns. And just when you think you know it's going one way, it's going another. Now, mind you, I will say right here emphatically, the 2014 version of this film was way more suspenseful and scary than the 2020 or the 2022 version of this same story. You got to watch it. You just got to watch the 2014 version. That said, this story is scary. It's spooky. And there's another element that's added to the story that focuses on kids. I'll get to it in a minute. I'll get to it in the description. Well, when I talk about the show, but it still very much is scary because it involves children. So in the next segment, I'm going to talk all about the 2022 version of Goodnight Mommy, starring Naomi Watts. So I'll go through the particulars as I know them. Then I'll just lay out the plot and walk through the comparison between it and the 2014 version of the same film. So stay tuned. Okay, so the last thing that I want to say when comparing The Good Son to Goodnight Mommy is that arguably both of these films call into question, or at least want us to think about, a child's mental health. If you've watched The Good Son, I think you know it's obvious. I think it's in a manipulative way. Macaulay Culkin's character wants the adults, or helps to lead the adults
to question Elijah Wood's character's sanity and how, whether or not they're acting out because of the divorce or feeling, being mad that they're not the only child anymore. In Goodnight Mommy, it's a little different. There's no accusations against the child. We're led to believe in the beginning that something is wrong with Mommy. I'll get into it in a second, but anyway, just think about that. And spoilers ahead, I know that this is a remake of a 2014 film, but in case you have not watched that, and I feel like it's pretty good that you would not have watched it. Well, I don't know. Maybe you have. Maybe you're from Austria. I don't know that I have anybody, any listeners from Austria, but I have listeners from Europe. So it's possible that you watched it. But, in case you haven't, spoilers ahead. Because to tell this story, I'm going to leave a really big element out, I think. Well, maybe. But yeah, I do want to tell this story right. So let me give you the particulars first. So Goodnight Mommy, as I told you, is a remake of a 2014 Austrian film. But this one was released, the recent remake, or the remake was released September 16th of this year. It was directed by Matt Sobel, produced by Nicholas Brigard Robert, David Kaplan, Joshua Ostrachan, and Vijay Guibel. Whatever. Production companies Playtime and Animal Kingdom. Executive producers Naomi Watts, Matt Sobel, Kyle Warren, Severin Fiala, Veronica of France, Derek Sang, and some other people. Anyway, it stars Naomi Watts, Cameron Corvetti as Elias, Nicholas Corvetti as Lucas. Peter Herman briefly appears as these two children's father. And then some police officers are here. The important thing to note is that this film predominantly spends the whole, is spent, the entire film is spent following Elias and Lucas, who are twins, as they navigate the life of children of divorced parents. So we meet Elias and Lucas being dropped off by their father at their mother's home. And you get the sense that this is not the first time that they've been here. It's been a minute. It's been a minute since they've been back. Maybe it's a summer sort of thing. Maybe it's a seasonal sort of thing, rather. Anyway, so they are dropped off at their mother's home, which here's the other thing about this film. It so strongly focuses on Elias and Lucas's relationship that we don't even know Naomi Watts's character's name other than Mommy. That's it. That's what we know. Dad's name is Dad. We don't get their first names because it's not important to the film. Anyway, so these twin stars, these twin actors who are probably aged 13, 14, but they're acting younger, they look as though they're like 9 or 10, maybe even 11. But these actors are clearly a little bit older. Anyway, so the premise is when twin brothers arrive home to find their mother's demeanor altered and her face covered in surgical bandages, they begin to suspect the woman beneath the gauze is not who she says she is. And to be honest with you, except for some sinister turns, this is like the premise of every single scary story for children. You've got these hero children who are uncovering a mystery. It's like a Scooby mystery, or what is it? Scooby-Doo and the Mystery Machine or whatever. It's like them. It's like a mystery for these teenagers to solve. Only these aren't teenagers. These are meant to be adolescents. And the mystery that they're solving is whether or not their mother is their mother. I'll get to that in a minute. But before I do that, let me just talk about the critical response. I will go out here. I've already said that the 2014 version of this film, the original, is better. That said, I don't think this is a bad film. I think it's mid. And looking at critics' scores, it's kind of all over the place. So IMDb, again, that source that I don't truly understand who the heck is voting, scoring these things, but IMDb has it 5.6 out of 10, which, feels about right. Feels about what I would give it. Rotten Tomatoes gives it a 37%, which let's find out how we got there. I don't know that it's 37%. It's not a terrible film. It's just not better than the original. And it's not the greatest, but it's not the worst either. It's middle of the road, but it's 37% rotten on the tomato meter with 59 reviews from critics. And it has an audience score of 35%, which includes 100 plus ratings from audience members. And the critics' consensus is Naomi Watts is talented as ever, but the Goodnight Mommy remake has no real reason to exist. Again, I go back to you. Hollywood loves recreating films because they love to make that buck. At the end of the day, these are movie making machines. These are money generating machines. Every single entertainment center, these are businesses. And the heart of a good business is a way to generate cash. And in the movie business, the entertainment business, the quickest way that you do that is to recreate something that was already successful, because when you bet on something new, it's risky. It's risky because if it's never been done before, or it's different to what's out and successful now, it might not be successful because you don't have anything to, the only thing you have it to compare to is something wholly different that you know is successful. And so if you are someone who's solely focused on money, making money and not the art of it, which is why we have so many conversations about artists coming out and saying they hate the music industry, or they have walked away from acting, or they've walked away from the art scene because of the corporate side of it. This is why. This is a prime example of why you take something that was so good and you recreate it, and you run the risk of creating a poor version of it. And so, according to these critics from IMDb, this is a terrible version of a really good film that they just should have let stand. But again, you know, everybody is entitled to their own opinion, and it's not middle of the road for my opinion. It's not mid just because it's a remake. It's mid because you don't add any new elements there. I'll get to it in a minute, and I think I'm actually talking myself out of mid as I'm speaking. But anyway, 70% of Google users like this film, of which I am one. Do I like this film, though? I think I don't, actually. I think I tolerate this film. I don't think I dislike it enough to say that I don't like this film, but I can't give it more than a mid. Anyway, so I've told you the actors, I've told you the critics' response, I've told you the premise that these two preteens, who are already dealing with the trauma of living in a split home and surely, you know, they've been engaged with, all right, I don't know what happened there, but anyway, I got cut off. Anyway, so yeah, this is a mystery. This film starts out as a mystery. These two children who are dealing with the trauma of divorced parents and being split between the two of them. Initially you get the sense that they're just trying to find some adventure a little bit. Because it's a coping mechanism. I don't want to deal with this. Let me use this other thing as a distraction. Again, when the children are dropped off by their father, I think it was Elias who asks Daddy if he wants to come in and see Mama for a bit. And you get the sense in that moment. Yeah, it was either Elias. I think it was Elias, actually, who asks. Or maybe it was Lucas. No, it was Elias. So Elias asks Daddy if he wants to come in to see Mommy, and he smiles very gently while he is yet at his own driver's side door. He doesn't even hug the babies or the children. They just kind of run off. And he's like, I don't think Mommy wants to see me right now. And so you get the sense that the split is recent, or you think that the split is recent. And so anyhow, so kids run off. Daddy drives off. This is the last we see of Daddy. We hear about Daddy, but we never see him again. We run into the home. The kids initially run into this beautiful home, whose door is just inexplicably open, which in America doesn't make any sense. In the 2014 version, it made perfect sense because they were in Austria, and you get the sense that perhaps the children were expected, and so the door was open, but that there was security around, and so, or at least, I don't know. To me, I dispelled a little bit of belief because it was a different country that I'm not used to. But the United States is a scary place, and everybody I know locks their doors. Even in the country, you lock your doors because stuff happens, and stuff tends to happen here in this gun-crazed, violence-driven society that we live in, where violence touches every single facet of our lives. It makes sense that perhaps, you probably should lock your doors. We've seen enough scary stories and real life crime scenarios where not locking your doors had very real consequences anyway. But these children run into the home, just big old modern home with big windows and very modern furnishings, and they're running around all over here, there, and everywhere, and trying to call in for Mama. They never find her. Can't hear Mama, can't nothing. And so they're entertaining themselves, and then boo, they find Mama, and Mama is in her bedclothes. And I will share that we never see Mama in real clothes again. Like we never see Mama outside of her nightgown and robe, never. But when these children meet their mom for the first time in this film, they're startled to find that she has a bandage on. And I will pause here to say the bandage that she has on her face is covering her entire face. It's essentially translucent. So we know what her face looks like. But these children are like taken aback as if they don't know what she looks like. And maybe they haven't been with Mommy in a minute, so they perhaps don't know what she sounds like. Perhaps, I don't know, but you get the sense that they're completely startled by Mommy having this face covering on, and her explanation for why the face covering on: I just had a surgery. Don't tell Daddy. And that's kind of it. And then she's kind of standoffish from there. And then Elias and Lucas go and put up their things. And Mama sets out dinner. Actually, she doesn't set out dinner. They make dinner for themselves. Mommy is smoking away and kind of hitting off. And throughout the film, we kind of see her on the phone in the early stages. And you know, she's kind of whispering to folks, and it's at this point, or she's kind of in rooms hushed talking with folks on the phone. And when she interacts with Elias and Lucas, the best way to describe it is that she's a little bit standoffish. So I could see how these children who have not been with their mother for a minute, who in the very beginning we see a memory of the two of them being tucked away in their bunk bed by Mama, and Mama is singing them a song, and she's very loving and it's lit warm. And so we are reminded in the film, or we're at least shown a memory from Elias and Lucas of a time when their mama was warm to them. And so they're looking for it now and they're not getting it. And the contrast is pretty unique. And I like this filming technique in that in the memory, things are warm. Even though it's night and it's relatively dark in the scene, this flashback scene where their mother is tucking them in and singing them a song, there's a nightlight on in the corner, and the light is glowing kind of gold. And so even though it's dark in this memory and the light is for the most part centered in the center of the frame or centered in the frame, it's still a warm kind of, it's warm. You get the sense that this is a warm memory, and warmth in many filming techniques equals happy. Good feelings. It's meant to generate good feelings. And then juxtapose against this cold modern home, the lighting is blue. It's like a blue tint to the lighting, and it's gray and it's kind of dark. And even though the boys are walking around in color, and even though there is yellow light in the room, it's like a pale yellow light. The lights are pale yellow. They're not the warm yellow of the memory. So you get the sense that it's kind of cold here. And so the only warmth that you really see is the warmth between Elias and Lucas throughout the film. And again, Mama, played by Naomi Watts, is for the most part of this film standoffish. And when she engages, you can tell that she's trying to do her best, but she's just having a hard time focusing. She's having a hard time engaging with the children. And then you begin to believe, you can see how Elias and Lucas, mostly Lucas, is like, something's wrong with Mama. Again, the note comes from Lucas, or at least the initial thought that something's wrong with Mama comes from Lucas. And so the seed is planted. And then these children, again, who are children of divorced parents, and probably the trauma of that home, that broken home, you get the sense that the memory that they went back to with their mother is also the time before the home was broken. And so you can see how it might be easier for a child to create this elaborate story of why mommy isn't warm to them anymore. It's because it's not actually mama. And how do we know it's mama? Because we can't see her face. And here's the other thing that you need to know. In this film, mama is a movie star. She's some sort of famous person. We don't know if daddy is, but we know that she is. And there's a moment in the film where, because Elias and Lucas Lucas is convinced, Elias is becoming convinced that Lucas, or that their mother isn't who she purports to be. There's a moment where they look as evidence of this being an imposter, because as evidence of her being an imposter, Lucas finds a photo of their mother. It's like a Hollywood headshot, or one of those paparazzi shots. And it's literally a headshot. She's looking at the camera. And in this headshot, her eyes are green. In real life, mommy's eyes are blue. And so because they are looking at mommy and she has blue eyes here, but in the photo, she has green eyes. Aha, this is evidence that this is not mommy, that this is an imposter. What have you done to mommy is becoming the question. And so they're increasingly getting bad. And by bad, I mean acting out. So now they're being a little bit disrespectful towards mommy, while mommy is still being standoffish. But mommy is like, okay, what's wrong with these kids now? Now mommy's alert. Mommy is alert to the fact that something strange is happening to her children. There is a moment where the behavior escalates to the point where not only are Elias and Lucas acting strange, but they begin to act out they begin to perpetrate actions on mommy. in the instance where the eye color change was discovered, this is something very drastic happens. And the drastic thing that happens is that Elias and Lucas duct tape mommy to the bed. And I think I might be skipping some stuff, but the point is there is a moment. Actually, no, before this happens, there is a moment where the Elias and Lucas run away to the barn to, or at least they try to run away to, they run away to a barn and it's uncomfortable in there for them. So they leave and then they run away to a home that they think people are living in because they're trying to get away from mommy. They're scared now. Mommy is really not acting right. She has not taken that face bandage off. She's just not acting right. And so they run to this house and they're so scared and it's rainy and it's cold. So they get into this house. They find that no one is at this house to save them because they're desperately trying to call their dad. And by this point, mommy has taken the phone from them because they're acting up. So mommy's taking the phone from them. They can't call their father anymore. So they try to run away to call their father to go pick them up because again, this is not mommy anymore. And they break into this home that is it's shuttered, but you get the sense that it's like a vacation home and it's no longer the vacation time of year for these people who used to live there. So they end up falling asleep in this home. And here come the police. The police come to get them and they think that they're saved here. And they think for a reason, obviously. So the reason why the police are alerted and come to the home is because there's a silent alarm in the home and the kids have tripped it when they broke in. And so these two police officers greet these children and Elias and Lucas begin to say that they're fleeing from danger. Their mother is not who she seems to be, and they need to get back to their father. And so these police officers say, okay, gotcha. I'm going to get you back to safety. And then they put him in a police car, and these children believe that they're going to the police station, perhaps, so that they can call their father. But what ends up happening is that the police officers drive them back to their mother's home. And of course they become distraught. And by this time, by the time that they've been driven back to mommy's home, she's taken her bandages off to reveal Naomi Watts, who I don't know that she's playing Naomi Watts. I think she's just playing a starlet, who is recognized by these officers. And one of the officers even tries to get her, get a photo with her, but she declines the photo because you can see that her face is still healing from whatever procedure she underwent. And then once the police officers leave, of course, the children are distraught and mommy is furious. Not furious. Furious is a too strong of emotion. Naomi Watts does not get above a 5 in this film. I got to be honest with you. She acts terrified. She acts mad, but like she's never above a 5 in terms of her the emotion that she displays. So she's annoyed at the fact that she's had to remove her face bandage or this face covering. It's almost like a compression sleeve. It looks as if it was a compression sleeve before your face. Anyway, or for your whole head rather. Anyway, she starts to moan and complain about the fact that she's had to remove this bandage sooner than she anticipated. And again, you get to see that she has bruising around her cheek area and closer to her ears. So maybe she had a facelift. Maybe she had injections. The point is, whatever she's had happen to her has not finished healing. Her face hasn't finished healing from it. But she had to take her bandage off so that she can talk to the police and they can know who she is. And when she has her face, her face is shown, the boys still don't believe it's her. Even though they know what their mother sounds like and know what their mother looks like, they're convinced that, or at least Lucas convinces Elias that she got a, this person, this imposter, got a face transplant to, or cosmetic surgery to look like their mother. And this is still not my mother. So we got to get away from her. And then it escalates to the point where more trickery is afoot. And then they bind her to the bed. So they bind her to the bed. And then this is where the contact discussion comes up. Like, oh, mommy's got green eyes and you have blue eyes. You're an imposter. You just made yourself look like her. And then she says, while she's tied up in the bed, because she's taking a nap again, she has never gotten out of her bedclothes, even to greet the police officers. She's still not in street clothes. She's still not in outside outerwear or outside wear. She's in, she's the only thing she was able to muster, or the only thing she was able to do, was put on some rain boots or something like that. She is still very much in her bedclothes. And so anyway, so she spends a lot of time sleeping. And in this one particular moment, the reason why they were able to bind her to her bed with duct tape is because she was asleep when they did it. And perhaps she was medically asleep in that she took some medication that really knocked her out. Meanwhile, she wakes up and then this whole eye change conversation comes up. Eye color change conversation comes up. And she's like, they're green contacts. Go look in my purse. And Lucas goes to her purse and tells Elias that, oh, I don't see any contacts. And Elias is this is the first point where Elias is like, are you sure? Are you sure that you don't see any contacts? And Lucas is like, you don't believe me? And Elias is like, well, of course I believe you. You're my brother. Like, again, they're twins. They're tight knit. They've been bonded through trauma, the trauma of their divorce, and the coldness between their parents and the coldness from their mother. So, you know, this is my ride or die. This is my ace. So I'm not going to disagree with you, but I just think it's, I want to look for myself. And we've all been there, right? Where we just have this urge to look for something ourselves, because maybe we love the people who went to look for us, but we know we could probably do a really good job. Because here's the other thing. Who wants to believe that their mother is not indeed their mother, but an imposter? And certainly Elias does not want to believe this. So we go through here. We go through this, but this, we move beyond the eye color thing, and mommy is still bound to the bed. And in a moment of weakness, Elias, who really just wants to know the truth, and again, does not want to believe that this is an imposter, or really wants to make sure this is an imposter before they take other drastic measures. Because up until this point, Elias and Lucas were packing to leave the home and leave their mother and go escape. Again, they've already done it once. They're trying to do it again. And so she's desperately trying to convince them that she is real. And so Lucas instructs Elias to shut mommy up by putting a sock in her mouth and putting duct tape over her face. And Elias reluctantly complies with this request. And so they're preparing to pack it up. And before you know it, so they're Elias is reluctantly grabbing his things to leave. And there's a knock on the door. It's the same police officers that dropped him off before. Again, Elias and Lucas were warning the police officers heavily, mightily, that they needed to be rescued from this mother who was an imposter, not actually their mother. And so one of the police officers comes back. Well, the pair comes back and checks on them, and they want to see their mother. And in this moment, Elias is standing in the door. Lucas decides he's going to hide behind the door. And Elias, but before Elias opens the door to the police officers, Lucas instructs Elias, don't say anything, just be cool. Because at this point, they've bound mommy to her bed upstairs, and they know that they'll get in some big trouble. And so even though Elias is frightened, and you could tell that he's frightened, Elias says nothing is wrong. Elias shoos off the police officers, Nothing is wrong here. And so the police officers reluctantly leave, and Elias and Lucas return to this, at this point, kind of harrowing escape, even though their mother is bound to their bed, but she has to be bound in order for them to truly escape. And so, but as we know, Elias is seriously questioning whether or not that this is her, their mommy, because Lucas is convinced, but Elias is not. And Elias keeps having these dreams. And this is, consider this film to have be happening over a weekend. And so by the time we get to this point where they're absolutely trying to leave, it's Sunday. And Friday and Saturday, or every time Elias has laid his head down, he keeps having this dream about the barn that they initially tried to sleep in when they escaped. But there was some weird substance on a post in the barn that really called him, and he wasn't sure what the heck it was. Well, we come full circle when, before escaping, Elias, in a moment of weakness, releases his mother. And Lucas is furious, but nevertheless, they're trying to escape. And somehow or another, this entire time, it is raining, very terrible weather. But it's raining and they're trying to escape, and they flee to the barn, this barn that Elias has been dreaming about, this barn that they initially tried to find some rest in, but couldn't really find rest. So they ended up going somewhere else. The first time they ran away, Elias, Lucas, and Mom end up in the barn. And it's at this moment where the film really takes a turn, and the conversation I said about a child's psyche, a child's mental health state, comes into play. Because it's at this moment where Mom begins to lead Elias up this ladder to the post where they that Elias has been dreaming about, that he saw that initial night when they ran away, that gave him pause because there was a substance on it. A dried up substance that was dark in color. And anyway, Mommy begins to do this, what appears to be an exercise that she's been meaning to walk him through. She's at her wit's end, and you get the sense that this is the reason why she's been kind of standoffish from her children. And you also are, you're also beginning to note at this point in the film that Mommy has been focusing on Elias this entire time. And even in this moment, she's focusing on Elias while Lucas is urging him to ignore her in the background. And then they go through this exercise where Mommy is trying to get Lucas to remember. To remember a very painful memory or a painful moment that Lucas is clearly, or that Elias is desperately trying hard to remember, and, or trying hard to forget, and Lucas doesn't want him to remember either. And it has to do with that post. And she keeps pressing and she keeps pushing. And Lucas, or Elias, is crying at this point, and Lucas is very quiet and small, kind of in the corner. And through this very tense scene, we see that, we learn that Lucas is, the red stain on the post, the beam that Elias has been focusing on and paying attention to, is actually blood. It's Lucas's blood, because that's where a horrible accident happened between Elias and Lucas, where unfortunately Lucas lost his life at the hand of his brother, Elias, who accidentally shot him. And so then we realize, you go back through the entire film, while Elias is currently trying not to process this, or just wanting this not to be true, you as a viewer go back through your mind and you think, oh boy, So this is why no one in the film was ever talking. No one in the film was actually ever talking to Lucas except for Elias. Yep, nobody ever acknowledged Lucas's presence, but because they're twins, you think, your eye thinks that they were acknowledging the both of them, but they actually weren't. Not ever. Not mommy, not the police officers, not daddy. Nobody acknowledged Lucas's presence but Elias. Also, you now understand a little bit why mommy was standoffish and distant and didn't treat them with the same warmth. It's because it wasn't a them, it was a he. It was a he who was still acknowledging the existence of his brother, or that his brother was still there, but mommy knew that he wasn't still there, but she didn't want to break the... It was a delicate situation, and so she didn't want to harm him any further. But at the same time, as a mother, she's torn apart because she knows her son is gone. So she has one son in the grave and one son whose delusions are leading him to believe that the other son is still here. His mind will not allow him to let his brother rest, his brother's spirit rest. So he's imagining that he's alive. He's conjuring him, essentially. And then you go back to the very first moment with the father, where the father is dropping off what we thought in the beginning was Elias and Lucas, but it was actually just Elias. When Elias was urging his father to come into the home, and the father says, "No, I don't think your mother wants to see me right now." Now you probably understand that this tragedy broke them up. And that perhaps maybe her cosmetic surgery was a pursuit for her to feel better. A pursuit to normalcy, or maybe just a cost of doing business as an actress, like something that's a part of her job. But nevertheless, the fact remains that we flash forward back to this very hard truth that mommy is trying to get Elias to confront. He doesn't want to confront it. He's screaming and crying. And in a fit of rage, he pushes mommy. And remember, they're up. This post that they're seeing, they had to climb up a ladder to get to it. And when Elias pushes mommy, he pushes her over this railing. And she falls. And unfortunately, she falls to her death. And somehow or another, the barn begins to catch on fire because inextricably in 2022, mommy goes out to the barn and uses a source of light, a kerosene lamp or a flame lamp. And so, of course, it falls over in this barn that inextricably has hay but doesn't have any animals in it. It falls over. And of course, the hay catches fire. And mommy's fallen to her death. Elias is now here, and not only is his brain too fragile to acknowledge that his brother has passed away, but now he escapes the barn, and he's sitting in the grass several hundred feet away from the barn and watches it collapse in flames. And while he's doing this, his brain is also too fragile to acknowledge that his mother is dead in the barn, so he conjures not only his brother in good health, but also alive and in good health, but also his mother alive and in good health. This child has slipped into delusion completely. And we end the movie. Now, the way I describe this, spoilers and all, it's poorly done, or it's not as well done as the 2014 version. The 2014 version ends in similar ways, but how we get there is altogether different, and it's scarier. It's still dark and gray, but it has an element of scariness that you don't get in this one, and you just need to watch it. There are a lot of things that are similar, but how we get there, the psychological pressure of getting there, is completely different. So I would invite you to go seek that out. I'm sure you can pull it down on one of the streaming services, but this version, again, I invite you to compare the two. This version of the film, though, I found it on Amazon Prime. It's you be the judge. I don't think it's a terrible film. I just don't think it compares well to the 2014 version. That said, that there are interesting elements in it, and the story itself, that the mind can be a scary place. Denial can be a horror all of its own. Reality could be scarier than anything that you conjure, that you imagine. That's scary too. Because behind religion and children, that one of the other scariest concepts, or the concepts that make movies scary to me, is the monsters we create in our head and not being able to differentiate reality versus fiction. So anyway, the 2014 version does a really good job of scaring you than this 2022. I invite you to watch it. But anyway, watch both and compare the two. Anyway, that's enough of that. I've talked enough. I appreciate you for listening. Take care of yourself. Like I said, next week I'll bring you a story of a jinn in Islamic culture. I'll bring you a story of a jinn. It's actually a little bit of a long one, but just stick in there before reviewing the next film that I review. And so I'm going to just keep doing that up because I love a good story and folk tales and folklore and even cautionary tales with religious cautionary tales, especially this time of year, are really my favorite thing to read and to focus on, just because it's an aspect of spirituality that we don't talk about often, but that Hollywood loves to exploit. But sometimes the scariest stories are scarier when told by folks who are practicing that faith rather than Hollywood, because Hollywood's gone Hollywood. Anyway, all right, but that's enough of that. Enjoy your day. Take care of yourself. Get boosted, flu, all of that stuff. Take care of yourself. We're going into cold and flu season. Take care of yourself. Take care of your body. It'll take care of you. Take care of your own wellness so that you can support the wellness of others as well. All right. Okay, thanks again for rating and reviewing this show. 5 stars or more favorably. We appreciate you. All right, until next time, take care.